Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Details at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM, their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments at adm.com/farmerview.
This is the July 19 edition of Commodity Week, recorded the 11th day of July.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find us online at willag.org.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM, their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at ADM.com/FarmerView.
I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. In studio with us today is Daryl Good, ag economist from the University of Illinois. Daryl, thank you for joining us. Let's talk a little bit about the marketplace and how things have proceeded from the drought-ridden year of 2012 into 2013 for old crop corn and soybeans first.
Well, for old crop corn, what we continue to see, I think, is a very tight supply situation as we wrap up the marketing year. The June 1 stocks number came in smaller than expected a few weeks ago, and I think we're continuing to see livestock numbers maintained at near year-ago levels. Suggest that things are going to get a little sticky perhaps before we get much new crop corn harvested. Unlike last year when the Midwest harvested a lot of corn in August, we don't really expect that to happen this year. And so we're not going to get much relief from new crop supplies other than the traditional southern state. So I suspect that old crop corn prices and bases is going to continue to be well supported right through the summer months and until we get into some harvest of the new crop.
And even with the southern states who traditionally would bring forth corn that might go in both directions, up and down the Mississippi River, maybe out to the southeast to feed the poultry's production plants there, and some of the hog and swine producers there too. They're 3 weeks behind as well this year.
Yeah, everybody's a little slow. I mean, you look at everybody except probably Texas. They're much slower than last year, but kind of on a normal pace. The other southern states tend to be lagging the five-year average in terms of maturity of the crop. So they will have a fair amount of corn harvested before September 1, the official beginning of the marketing year, but certainly not as much as last year, and maybe not as much as in an average year. So we always count on those early season supplies, and they're going to be a little more limited this year.
I suppose, and maybe we can go back to something that's been tickling the marketplace for quite some time, that with this late growing season across the United States, especially in the southern part of the U.S., the balance sheets, by the time we get to the grain stocks report and that will come out in later September, will be of September 1, might actually show something that would be considered correct by the whole of the trade.
Yeah, we shouldn't have any concern about mixing of old crop, new crop supplies, I think, in the surveys for the September 1 stocks report. So it should be a number that whatever it turns out to be should be a reliable, acceptable number to the trade.
Let's take up this time frame from July, August, September on into October 1, I suppose, when harvest will really begin to take place in a greater part of the Corn Belt. There's a point at which there will be corn left, but not very much, and basis is already showing $1.50 in the later to early parts of July for delivery. And I'm wondering what things will look like when we get into the month of August and the first half of September.
Well, I think there's a bit of a problem when we are quoting basis levels now on corn, because The trade is bidding off of the September contract, which is a heavy discount to July futures. So if you really calculated bases relative to July futures, we've been running about 10 under here in recent weeks, which is a pretty normal basis. I think the problem is that September futures are being priced more as a new crop contract right now than it is an old crop contract. So that you've got this huge inversion in the futures market that gives you then, by definition, a very strong basis when you're bidding off of the September contract. And so as the July contract goes off the board and matures, bases, in fact, will be record strong because cash, old crop cash prices are going to stay robust, I'm convinced, until we get this through the marketing year and into the new harvest. And September futures are going to be continue to be priced more as a new crop contract. So I think unless that changes, unless September takes on a bit of a more of an old crop flavor, we're going to continue to see a very, very strong basis on corn going into August.
You know, there are other years in the past when the September has looked more like an old crop month by the time we got to the harvest season?
Yeah, I think in most years it does. I haven't looked at that specifically. You know, we've always thought of September as kind of in no man's land. It didn't know whether to be an old crop or a new crop contract, and we thought it would depend on the market's perception of how early harvest would be. And so in that context, it's a little surprising, given the lateness of this year's corn crop, that September hasn't taken on a little bit more of an old crop characteristic rather than so much new crop. It just seems to be too heavily discounted relative to July futures. But that being the case, it comes back to your point that when we quote bases, it's going to look extremely strong going into the rest of the summer.
Oftentimes that basis will give a cash price in the neighborhood of $7, which seems to be a place where farmers are willing to let go. But most of the corn, as you know, is not in the hands of farmers, but in the hands of elevator operators. Are they more likely to wait it out for a bit?
Well, again, that's kind of a tricky question because I think the corn that's in the elevator, my gut feeling is that a lot of that is owned by the farmer. And I would not think that elevators, that commercials, would be owning much grain outright, even if or even hedged, because of the strong inversion in the market and the strong basis. There's little incentive for a commercial to hold grain. So my guess is that much of that off-farm stocks is owned by farmers, and we're getting down to kind of the stubborn few holding on to old crop corn. And so it's kind of a game that's being played here, that things are going to stay tight, prices are going to stay strong until the day that we get some new crop corn coming in, and then that old crop price is going to collapse. So I think right now farmers are in a strong position. It's only July. We've got another 6 weeks to go before the marketing year is over. But someday that we're going to see that whole cash price and basis give way.
Last fall, I remember you saying, when I asked, should a farmer sell it across the scale or store it? It doesn't usually, in years like this, pay to store it. That's still been the case until recently when we came back to these bigger cash prices, meaning that a lot of corn that was stored probably moved at lower prices. So the question now is, should those folks who've been stubborn let go sooner rather than later?
Well, I think, they're going to have to let go before new crop harvest. Otherwise, you're going to end up selling old crop $7 corn for $4.50 as new crop corn. So it's kind of a cat and mouse game right now, but there will come a day of reckoning when a new crop is available. So sooner, by definition, that crop needs to be moved.
How about soybeans for the old crop?
Old crop, again, a very tight situation on stocks. Clearly that we're going to end the year with minimal carryover of soybeans. And the thing that we have to watch, I think, is these monthly crush numbers. And the frustrating part of that is they are monthly, so there's very large time lags here. But on July 15th, I think we'll get the June crush number from NOPA, and that'll tell us whether the pace of soybean crush has been declining rapidly enough to stretch these supplies into the new harvest. And the needed cut is pretty dramatic because the crush has stayed so robust all year long, and now we're down to the last 3 months of the marketing year, and crush needs to cut back in order to make the supplies last. The run-up that we've seen in soybean meal prices suggests that perhaps the crush is being cut back fairly dramatically and getting some tight supplies of soybean meal. But that number will be extremely important to tell us how much more rationing we have to do before new crop is available. And my guess is we've got a fair amount of rationing still to do. In some respects, I feel like the soybean market really didn't do a proper job this year of rationing the crop. Prices did go extremely high early in the year, but it appears to me, one, they may not have gone high enough, or two, didn't stay at those levels long enough really to get the rationing process completed, and we're having to do that right through the remainder of the crop year.
But USDA is already at 125 million bushels for the carryout. I don't think they changed that on the WASDE report. They did not in the month of July. That's a 4% stocks-to-use ratio. It's also, when you tally it up, it's also pipeline levels.
Right.
And I know that you're aiming at 125, so that's what they want left, but you sound as if we might not even make that.
Well, it's a question of, can you go lower than 125? And if you can, we may do that. If you can't, and my point being, if you can't go lower than 125, we've got to cut some additional consumption over the next 2 months in order to maintain inventories at that level. And that's what that June crush number will tell us is, okay, for the last 2 months of the year, how much cutback in the crush do we need to see in order to ensure that we have a pipeline inventory by harvest time?
Will we make it?
We'll make it, but the question is, what will price have to do in the last 6 weeks to make sure that that happens?
It could make the futures kind of fun to watch, I suppose, or will that happen in the basis as well?
I would guess a lot of it will happen in the basis for soybeans. We probably will see, again, August futures are such a discount to July as July goes off the board, which is, again, somewhat of a mystery why August, clearly an old crop soybean contract, is a $1.20 discount to July when this extreme tightness is going to persist right through the month of August.
As we wrap up the first part of the show, look back on 2012 as a production year, a drought year. How does it compare? What stands out in your mind?
Well, I think the thing that stands out most to me is how quickly the drought unfolded in 2012. Many people were referring to it as a flash drought that, you know, we went through the spring and into early June in what we thought was remarkably good condition. It was a little bit on the dry side, but plenty of soil moisture, early planting, and then the spigot just shut off very quickly in June and into July. And then with the extremely high temperatures, really did a lot of crop damage. Couldn't have happened at a worse time in terms of the growing season. So I just think the nature of that was so much different than what we'd seen in, say, 88, which was a very early drought. It persisted for quite a while. Even 80 and 83, which was more of a gradual development. 2012 really caught a lot of people off guard.
Did it tell you anything about corn hybrids and their ability to yield? I'm thinking that the devastation level between 88 and 2012 wasn't all that different.
I think you're exactly right. I think the way to think about it is deviation from trend, and in both years, I think we're about 40 bushels below trend. So I think the drought probably had equal impact in both years.
40 bushels, but 40 bushels in 2012 would be a lot different than 40 bushels in 1988.
Yeah, but you have a lot higher trend. But so we measure trend in bushels, and so we measure deviation from trend in bushels, and so a very similar impact. In terms of percentage, it's very different, but in terms of the impact of the drought, very, very similar results.
Can you explain the difference to me on that one between the math of it and the perception of it? Because one sounds equal and one does not.
Well, it's whether you do it in bushels or percentage, I guess, is the basic difference. And when you're, you know, 25 years ago at a 50 bushel lower trend, 40 bushels is a bigger percentage, obviously, than it is of a much higher trend. But 40 bushels is still 40 bushels, and kind of in that respect, I think is the way I would measure the impact.
Yeah, so, which is to say that this weather was equal to 40 bushels. A similar weather phenomenon, again, was equal to 40 bushels.
That's the way I think about it. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. We're talking with Daryl Good. He's an ag economist at the University of Illinois. You're listening to Commodity Week. We recorded on the 11th day of July, so about a week and a couple of days ago. We'll return in just a couple more minutes and talk about the new crop prospects. Term of the day is hedge as it relates to agricultural commodity price hedging. A typical hedger might be a commercial farmer, so the market value of wheat, for instance, and other crops fluctuates constantly as supply and demand for them vary, with occasional large moves in either direction. Based on current prices and forecast levels at harvest time, the farmer might decide that planting wheat, for instance, is a good idea one season, but the forecast prices are only that, forecast. Once the farmer plants wheat, he's committed to it for the entire season. If the actual price of wheat greatly rises between planting and harvest, the farmer stands to make a lot of unexpected money. But if the actual price drops by harvest time, he could be ruined. If at planting time the farmer sells a number of wheat futures contracts equivalent to his anticipated crop size, he effectively locks in the price of wheat at that time. The contract is an agreement to deliver a certain number of bushels of wheat to a specified place on a certain date in the future for a certain fixed price. The farmer has hedged his exposure to wheat prices. He no longer cares whether the current price rises or falls because he is guaranteed a price by the contract. He no longer needs to worry about being ruined by a low wheat price at harvest time, but he also gives up the chance at making extra money from a high wheat price at harvest time. However, in the case of a farmer, it must be noted that the hedge introduces another kind of risk. If the farmer has contracted to sell all his expected crop but then has a bad year, for instance, a year with lower than expected yields, such that his farm is not able to produce the committed quantity, he may have to purchase replacement crop at a disadvantageous price to fulfill his futures contract. And that's our trading term for the day, hedge, as it relates to agricultural commodities. This is the July 19 edition of Commodity Week, recorded the 11th day of July. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking today with Daryl Good, ag economist from the U of I. Daryl, let's take up new crop supplies for corn and soybeans, a crop that is now in the ground and growing. By all accounts, looks really pretty good, at least for corn.
Really does. I mean, as of mid-July, you would have to say the eastern part of the growing area, including most of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, Tennessee, in remarkably good condition, I think with above average or above trend yield prospects in those areas. That's offset a bit by a more ragged later crop, particularly in north-central Iowa, southern Minnesota. A little bit of heat stress developed in July in western Nebraska, western Kansas. Dakotas looked remarkably good. So, you know, just setting in mid-July, looking at the crop and looking at current soil moisture, current weather conditions, you kind of conclude we have a very good crop potential this year. But then also you have to remind yourself you can kind of discount everything that's happened to date and basically reset the clock, because now we're entering that critical period of crop development and reproduction when weather really becomes extremely important. And this is when we either make or break the crop in July and August. So, yeah, we feel pretty good right now about our production prospects and kind of optimistic that we can, that the weather will hold together through the remainder of the growing season.
Good about the production prospects. The July WASDE, your World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate, say for corn that if realized, it would be the largest crop on record, and the last record crop was set in 2009.
Right, and so pushing a 14 billion bushel crop based on the June acreage survey and the USDA's estimate of our yield potential. And I think that's a realistic number. I think we'll probably lose some acreage from what we saw in the June survey, particularly harvested acres, but I think also planted acres will be lower. But even if we lose a couple million acres, I think our yield potential is higher than what the USDA is projecting at this point. That would more than offset any loss of acreage. So, again, just setting where we are mid-July, you would have to say 14 billion bushels is still in the crosshairs, still a very good possibility for 2013.
On the date we recorded this conversation, corn futures had moved higher through that previous week, and they were touching levels, I think, that many thought might be a good spot for producers to sell a second portion of their crop. I'm wondering what your thoughts might be.
Yeah, you know, this market, I think, is having a really tough time trying to settle in on what they think the crop size is. So this kind of variability in price, I think, is going to continue. But ultimately, if we do harvest the kind of crop that we potentially have, I think prices will be much lower than what they are right now. So I think this is the kind of strength that would be used if you haven't sold anything yet, or if you're looking for another increment of sales, you know, in the 520 to 550 range. These corn is probably not a bad target. Yes, if weather really turns sour on us in the end of the growing season, those will not look like good sales. We will see some price recovery, but it's just kind of a risk management scenario at this point.
Speaking of risk management scenarios, there will be some that want to manage the risk in 2014, the crop insurance risk and other, I suppose, should they?
My opinion is yes. Here's my concern. If we get a 14 billion bushel crop, we push corn prices 50 cents lower than what they are right now, and that will be reflected in the 2014 price as well. Then what prevents us from doing that again next year, another 14 billion bushel crop, another billion bushels added to carry over, and another 50 cents lower in price. So I think there is some real downside risk on 2014 prices. The question is whether that downside risk will materialize before crop insurance prices are established in February of next year. And my concern is it will, and that we may be looking at what we would consider to be very low price guarantees on crop insurance come February of 2014. Interestingly enough, December 2014 futures are at a premium to 2013. You can sell that crop 20 to 25 cents higher than the 13 crop. I think we ought to be doing it.
Do you have a strategy for that? Are you going to do it with options, or you just hedge?
No, I you know, if you can cash flow it and manage the cash flow risk, I think hedging is the way to do it. I wouldn't approach it with options at this point. If you can't manage the cash flow, then hedge to arrive or just cash contracts would be the way to go.
Soybeans are a different subject, I think, even on this point, aren't they?
To me, they are. I think, again, if you say what's our potential production for 2013, I think it's still quite large, potentially a record crop of soybeans. But I sense that there's a little more yield risk on soybeans, perhaps even than corn this year, because of the overall lateness of the crop. We had a very large percentage of the crop planted late. A lot of replant, even double crop beans got planted a little late because of, in some areas, because of delayed wheat harvest. You've got late plantings in some really vulnerable areas, I think, western and northern part of the Corn Belt. That means that yields could be jeopardized by just running out of growing season this year. And that's been, in my opinion, reflected in the soybean market. November futures, I think, have stayed a little more robust than corn futures, recognizing there is perhaps some production risk there associated with late planting. And if we do get a production surprise, to me, it may come in the soybean market. So I would be a little more cautious on soybeans, perhaps, than corn in terms of forward pricing.
For both years, then?
For both years, but particularly for 2013.
Yep. For this year.
Right.
Yeah. When you look at 2013 and 2014, based on some of the work that you and Scott Irwin have done, as it relates to the RFS, or the Renewable Fuel Standard, which usually we think about as ethanol, but also impacts biodiesel or diesel fuel that could be made for vegetable oils like soybean oil, how much of an impact do you think it might have?
You know, that is an important and developing issue, I think, because EPA has an opportunity to revisit the RFS in terms of particularly the advanced mandate. And I think signals are that as we continue to write down the cellulosic ethanol mandate, that the EPA may also write down the total advanced mandate, which they have not done in the past. And that's a real, to some extent, a big game changer, because if you don't write it down, then what you're doing is you're really motivating the need for much larger quantities of biodiesel as we move forward. If you do write down the advanced mandate, then those requirements are going to be considerably less, still increasing, but at a slower rate. So there's going to be some continued, I think, increased consumption of soybean oil for biodiesel. The rate of that increase is going to hinge very heavily on what EPA decides to do.
One final question. The corn crop in the southern hemisphere, particularly out of Brazil, are the economics there that would cause that to continue to be produced?
You know, the general thinking is that supply response that we've seen in Brazil to these higher prices is kind of a non-reversible supply response. Once production takes place, you get the acreage in place, you get the infrastructure in place, you don't back up. If we move to a lower price scenario, that will certainly stop or slow the rate of increase in corn production. But I think most people believe that we probably would not reverse that process.
Darrell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Darrell Good, ag economist at the University of Illinois, joins us here on this edition of Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for Commodity Week comes from Agrigold Hybrids, featuring the Agrigold Giants, a group of five hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at agrigoldgiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM, their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at adm.com/farmerview.